I've got the pleasure right now of welcoming a wonderful pianist. Her name is Jenny Slotcher, and she has a new album out, which is full of beautiful, soulful music. It's called American Heritage. And first of all, let me welcome you, Jenny, to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here and to talk about this music. As I mentioned, the CD is called American Heritage, the recording, and it's a tribute to American folk music, but also, as I read here, a tribute to your own Southern roots. Now, you don't sound very Southern. Are you from the South?
I spent my early years in the South. South Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, we moved a lot. My parents settled in Nashville, and shortly thereafter, after a couple of years of high school, I went away to college and then to New York. So I spent my summers away at Aspen and Interlochen. So in a sense, I grew up north rather than down south.
Yeah, but in a way, it's a return, I guess, for you to exploring some of your Southern roots, original roots. Let's talk about some of the music on here. It's a collection of shorter works by composers. Some will be familiar names, some not quite as familiar to our listeners, but there are a lot of African-American composers on here. There are some women composers. What was your focus in creating this recital program, basically? What did you want to create?
Well, it was a very organic process. Many people ask me this. My friends and my colleagues know that I've had this music in my repertory for a long time, some of it more than three decades, actually. I was always attracted to music, well, to the spirituals, because they're so spiritual and so moving. And the music wasn't always easy to find, but I ended up skipping a lot of classes in high school and going over to the college across the street and spending time in the stacks looking through scores of music. Don't tell anybody. But I always loved the discovery of new and unusual things to present to an audience along with the standard repertory that I was expected to play. But I thought it was also some respite for the audience as well, because they would recognize something and it would be also provocative in a sense. So most of this music I had, like I said, for a long time, I included in programs. I always have played the Deep River, the Troubled Water, and the Down by the Riverside. I used to call that my Holy Water Trilogy. Mm. And I used to play those three all together because they're such different styles, but they're all based on spirituals that all are about water, the symbolism. I also did another grouping like that. So it was a very organic process. Originally, it was just going to be a very American program. That's what it was going to be. And then I found that everything came, all the ideas and the interest and the inspiration for these composers came to our shores with the first enslaved African people.
Yeah.
So that was an eye-opener for me, because I did not necessarily associate Shenandoah or Suwannee River with that. It was only later that I discovered that those were marine work songs that came from the great rivers of Africa over to America.
Yeah, and I did not know that either. Really interesting. And it kind of affects the way that you listen to that music as well. You mentioned that a lot of this repertory has been in your blood, so to speak, for a long time. You've been playing it for a long time. What was the first piece from this group?
The first piece from this group was the Juba Dance. And that was when I was spending the couple of years I spent in Nashville studying at very prestigious, the Blair School of Music, that's part of Vanderbilt University now. I was a merit scholarship winner there. And one of the other students had this piece, that it was her piece, and the music was hard to come by. So it wasn't like she was gonna share it. That often happens. And and she was a wonderful pianist. Wow. I learned it by ear off of her performance because I could do that. And I started playing it by ear, and eventually I found the score.
So the Juba Dance is by Robert Nathaniel Dett, right? Or his arrangement of that. Now, tell people what a Juba Dance is if they don't know.
Okay, Juba, it could be D-J-U-B-A in Haiti, Juba from Africa. It's a dance that's based on a certain rhythmic pattern, and it gets its name from Patton Juba. That was the dance that the enslaved people did on the plantation. And often it's called the hand bone, but meaning hand bone, because the dance is articulated by the hard part of the hand of the wrist tapping on various parts of the body. In doing that, you can get high tones, low tones, so the whole time the feet are moving. It's very complex. It's got polyrhythms going on in there. And William Henry Lane of Master Juba made that dance famous all over the globe, all the way to, you know, dancing for Queen Victoria. So, it's a fabulous little dance. And there are lots of instances of it being used in various, like Florence Price, she uses it as the last movement of her piano concerto, and some of the other composers, you see that it's used. And it's probably the most famous of Dett's works because it was, you know, popularized, and Percy Grainger played it. And, it's a fun piece.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other music on here. I'm struck by the fact that there's such a variety. Even in familiar tunes, there's a lot of variety going on in the arrangements. Now, you did an arrangement yourself of the Shenandoah song, right?
Yes, I did. I heard a performance of Keith Jarrett playing this, and as usual, performance was very moving, but it was very minimalistic and very stark. So I learned that by ear. And to that, I began to build it out, add some ornamentation, octave displacement, a la Busoni with his art of transcription. I wasn't looking to improve it. I just found that I loved the song. I loved the piece. And as I played it, I just did something different every time with it. And then, of course, the discovery that it was originally called Shenandoah. Like I said, it was a marine work song, a capstan shanty. And I was fascinated with that. I started reading about the flat-bottom boats that sailed out of South Carolina and the black crews and how they'd sing these songs to keep time with the paddling. All of these things just fascinated me. And so I thought, you know what? This is, again, another instance of a piece working its way into, you know, our culture from Africa. Fascinating.
So you talk about Shenandoah. I mean, obviously that was an eye-opener for you. That was a discovery in this journey of creating the album. Did you discover anything else when you were putting all this together? Anything strike your thought process?
Yeah, and like I said, I've got a large body of this music. I didn't know what would go together on an album. You know, it was just like with my other albums. I needed another piece, but I couldn't just stick another piece on it. So it was something that just was, well, that's right, that makes the program. And so this, I lived with this for quite a while, and I had to delay the recording several times because my father was in declining health and I didn't want to have to cancel. So I kept exploring and reviving some of my repertory. I was, and likewise the same way, I was surprised that Suwannee River was, Mobile River was also a marine work song. And, also the other thing about the album is that there are 18 tracks. They're all very different, even within the Burley. And the Burley is really an eye-opener. I've loved that piece for many years.
Yeah.
And, I judged a piano competition at a historical black college and university where all the students had to do one, black composer. And so I listened to a lot of this music being played for a few years. And nobody ever played that piece because it's so sparse. You know, it belies the difficulty and the nuance of it, the Burley from the Southland. And I knew I would never hear it from the students, but it's a pity. But I loved that piece for many, many years. And then finally being able to record it was really a revelation.
Yeah, Harry Burley, I mean, people think of him through his association with Dvorak.
Yes.
And his New World Symphony and such. But he also was somebody who touched on other composers of African descent as well. I mean, he was a supporter, it says here in your program notes, of Samuel Coleridge Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so there's some interconnectedness going on between...
That was another thing about the program. I'm sorry to mention that, but when you, I saw that there were relationships all through these people. You know, William Grant Still, he decided to be a serious composer because of the life of Samuel Coleridge Taylor. And they all, you know, they were supportive of each other. Some studied with the other. So there are stories to be told throughout the album. And I really could see how this fits together because it tells a story and a short piece. Like the shortest piece of the blues from Lenox Avenue, my hope was that it would lead people, oh, I love that, or I like that, and it would lead them to the larger works, like his Afro-American Symphony, which is a powerful work, used to be performed all the time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the thing was hoping that it would you know, spider outward and people would, you know, investigate more of these composers.
I'm interested in the composer Frederick Shevsky. You've got his arrangement of Down by the Riverside on there, and his music and his arrangement, I mean, it's a familiar tune, but he sends it through the blender, as it were. There's a lot of stuff
yes.
going on there. Why did you decide to include his arrangement of that piece?
Well, I don't know that there's any, the other thing about these pieces is that they're all something to chew on for a pianist and for a musician. You know, there are challenges here, and it's such a different style than the beginning, the spiritual, the very beginning. The first one, and then you go all the way to the end and you see the trajectory of what somebody could do with this music and have it be authentic. It was Pete Seeger that recommended to Frederick that he should pick a folk song. If he was going to do folk songs, and these were, you know, work songs of the 30s, was how Frederick put it together, you should do it in the manner of the Bach chorale preludes, where there's, you know, there's invention, there's inversion, there's, you know, fragmentation, so all of these different methods that Bach would use, but everybody always knew the chorale because they sung that all the time, so it was easily identifiable. So it was Pete Seeger's idea when Frederick was looking for what to do, and of course this is from the North American ballads. There's four of them. I happen to always love this one. I love Down by the Riverside. I associate it with the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, anti-nuclear movement, and of the 60s that, you know, you see on TV and you hear it. I wasn't there, but it's rousing, as rousing now as it is then. And I love that gospel, that the ends with this big gospel improvisation that just blows my mind because it's so authentic. I actually played it for Frederick early on, like, you know, I guess maybe even in the early 90s, I played it for him. They're massive, the work is massive, all four of them. And I learned it very quickly because I knew he would be coming stateside. And it was a wonderful experience, and I've had it in my repertory ever since.
Sort of at the other end of the spectrum, you've got music of Louis Moreau Gottschalk on here. You want to talk a little bit about his contribution to this program?
Yes, I do, because that's very important, because he's a visionary, first of all. He cut a path that other composers negated. They just negated until half a century later when Gottschalk was incorporating plain song. He was incorporating the African music, the melodies, the Creole melodies, the Caribbean melodies into concert pieces in the 1840s. Nobody else was doing that. And he did it very successfully. The harmonies are daring. The rhythms are shocking for that period of time. I mean, we take it for granted because we hear a lot of Gottschalk, but also, it's very important. That banjo as well, it always reminded me of the minimalist American composers, Stephen Reich, Philip Glass, and the little repetitions of this modular unit that spins around is quite a virtuoso work. And then the ending, which most people think is Camp Town Races, is actually not. It's another Marine song called Sing and Heave. And Gottschalk had just award Stephen Foster for his association with the minstrels that distorted this wonderful music. So yes, I think he was a trailblazer. And then you have half a century later, composers are starting to do that. So he was doing it at a time no one else was, and he was doing it very authentically, never sounded derivative. And I like to put them on there because also it's a different kind of pianism and pianistic writing that's on the rest of the record. There's lots of contrast there.
Just fascinating, the stories and the discoveries behind some of these composers that even somebody like myself who plays this music on the radio all the time, I was not aware of Suwannee River and Shenandoah, the backstory there. I was not aware of Louis Moreau Gottschalk and his, ideas and his visionary thinking in regards to music of African Americans. I mean, it's really a wonderful program.
Thank you so much.
Can folks find out more information online? I know that there are sort of in-depth little essays that you have for each of these pieces and these composers. Is that included in the CD, or do they have to go on the internet?
I had to greatly abridge mine. I love to write. I work on it. It's an ongoing adventure for me since writing and publishing about the Busoni works I did. And I had to greatly abridge them for the booklet. The label had, was very strident about, just a couple lines on each.
Yeah.
It was a bitter task to do that, to abridge them. But I put the complete essays, they're short, on each piece, and there are wonderful stories in there about the composers and about the history surrounding some things that happened to them, like how churches began to be desegregated because of Harry Burley and what happened when the choir quit, when they hired him. And it's fascinating stories in there. And so, my website is jennyslotchever.com, and you can find those there. And, there's some good reading there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll link to that from our website at WGTE.org.
Right.
The album is called American Heritage. This is your first release, right, for Soho Records?
First for Soho, yeah.
Yeah. But you have released albums in the past.
On Centaur, I have the three Busoni, the Visionary volumes.
Yeah.
Which I had anticipated, this would go, the record was made in 2018 before the pandemic. There were lots of delays in post-production.
Yeah.
And then what happened was Soho came to me and they wanted it. They expressed an interest and I thought, pandemic happened. I was very confused about what to do next, but they kept coming back. They said, what can we do to get this? And their enthusiasm really impressed me. So I said, fine, take it, it's yours.
Well, I think it's great that you were able to still share this in spite of everything going on with the pandemic. So I want to mention your website again and spell your name just so folks know. Jenny is spelled J-E-N-I. Slotchever is S-L-O-T-C-H-I-V-E-R. I got that right, yeah?
Yeah. That's
okay. Right. Okay. And again, we'll link to that. The album is American Heritage, pianist Jenny Slotchever, who has joined me to talk about some of this wonderful music. So much stuff here that we could dive into, but I think perhaps the best thing for folks to do is to listen to the album. And if they're interested in the stories, they can read your essays at your website. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us, talking about and sharing the music here on FM 91.
I'm so happy you invited me on. It's a wonderful time.